Do you have anything like special prepared for the young local hero?
I always have something special prepared for everyone.
The engines actually made chess much more rich. Like a lot of people were expecting chess to die just because of the engines and most variations to just die, which is the case with some variations, but it also made it more rich. What was our latest discussion? Was it me versus 50 geese?
Well, I think that you don't stand a chance against even like 10 geese.
Boom. Welcome back, everybody. Here we go. Middle of the tournament in Bucharest. It's been going quite well so far. You're sharing first against Prague. With Prague, alongside Prague.
Not just Prague. Also, it's two players who are sharing first. So, I mean, I'm sharing with two players.
I'm trying to remember.
Like, how do I not remember this? I'm just blanking completely.
It's not Levon, because he lost one, he won one.
Yeah, he's 50%. It's not due to his minus
one. Enviol.
Yeah, Maxime. Of course. He won two games.
Of course.
Won two games, lost the first round to Alireza. Could have won three games in a row.
Yeah.
He was winning against Levon. But drew that game, won two others, two nice games. Nice game against Wesley. And very nice game against Gukesh. Against Wesley, it was nice, but there were some hiccups. Against Gukesh was a really nice game. So, yeah, three of us in first.
Plus one, that's not bad. Plus one was the winning score last year, as in you make it to the tie breaks and you win it. I think 2 years ago it was, what, plus two?
Plus two, clear first.
It's always a very low scoring event. But generally it goes...
There was a plus three in 2020. Chakriar, but also I think 2022, the tie with Levon, Maxime, and Wesley. But maybe it was plus two. No, I think that was plus two. They shared three ways.
Yeah. Why do you feel that is? Is it the first classical of the season, of the Grand Chess Tour season? And then everybody tries to stay somewhat tight, given that, you know, the top three qualify to the next year, like the whole...
Yeah, I don't
incentive
think so.
Incentive structure is...
I don't think so. Like, this year it's a bit up and down. It's just that...
This year is different, yeah.
Yeah, just still... You don't get so many chances. I mean, you get a few, but usually you don't get so many chances. I think Maxime got more chances than you normally get so far. Three out of five games. I got one chance, realistically, which I took against Alireza. I had, a tiny advantage against Prague, but in a complicated position. It wasn't really a chance. It was just... If I had played perfectly from that point on, probably would have won. But
yeah,
it's not like I was much better. Who else got chances? Like Prague got one. Did Gukesh get chances? I think he's been mainly in bad positions. He did have a chance in the Dayak. He was much better. He was also objectively
losing.
Yeah, it was an up and down game. He could have also lost against Duda. So Gukesh has been in a dangerous
pretty bad shape, actually. I don't know. It's not his usual self, right? His usual self calculates very well, doesn't really get in too much trouble. Like, if you could take Gukesh from the Olympiad or the candidates, he's had maybe one or two bad positions the whole two tournaments. Right now, he's getting into last positions on a regular basis in, the first, five games.
Sure. It's one event, and it's only half of one event, so I wouldn't...
Yeah.
Read into anything yet. I mean, I had a terrible event in Vikingsay.
Yeah.
It's,
it's not his event so far. At least not the
no,
first
so far.
Time.
He's minus one. Obviously, he's not having a good one so far, but four games to go. If he wins two, I think he can, two of the remaining four, he can be reasonably happy with his performance.
Yeah.
Even if it's probably not enough to win, usually, plus one, but still can be reasonably happy. If he scores on minus, it's a pretty... it's an event to forget about if that happens, but still four games to go. I play him in the last round too, so I don't want to jinx anything. I mean, I'm playing black against Gukesh. It's obviously a tough game in the last round.
Yeah. Actually, seven players, I think, scored victories in this one so far. So there's been a bunch of decisive results.
Dayak has beaten Levon.
Yeah.
Levon
seven players.
Has beaten Duda. Duda and Gukesh have not won a game.
Duda, Gukesh, and Noderbeck.
Noderbeck is also minus one.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And everybody else has won at least one game.
So wait, so Duda, Gukesh, and Noderbeck are the only ones on minus score?
Correct.
And 3 on plus score.
Correct.
And the rest on 50%. That's, yeah, that checks out. I was in serious danger against Wesley.
Yeah.
I mean,
what happened there, actually?
You know, it's like, of course, I've played the Sveshnikov for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Since I was a kid, it was my childhood opening in some ways. It was recommended to be by one of my early coaches, by the late Miron Scherer, who was a big coach of kids back in New York. He was a coach of, like, Robert Hess, many U.S. players as well that maybe our viewers won't be too familiar with, but they'll definitely be familiar with Robert Hess, for example, and who also became a strong grandmaster.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so he was my coach also for several years. And one of the openings he recommended to me was, like, the Smyslov variation against Rui Lopez, which isn't... It's like bishop b5, g6. It's probably not considered a very good line these days. And I don't think it was considered very good then. But then when I became a bit stronger, he recommended I play the Sveshnikov. So it was one of my childhood openings from, like, the ages of, I don't know, 10 to 14, something like that, right? Then eventually I went to other openings of French. I was a big French player for a long time. And so I have a lot of experience going back from a young age, and I prepared it for the candidates, for example. I've prepared it for a lot of events. I've played it, like, on and off for years. But nobody plays the old stuff against me. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. totally out of fashion.
Nobody plays it.
So if people go for the Sveshnikov, they go for knight d5 c3, knight d5 c4, like, exclusively, from my experience, for many years now. Bishop takes f6. I had one game in the Olympiad 2022 against a player from Greece. Trying to remember. But yeah, that was the last time that I faced it. And this particular line that Wesley played. No.
Not the... what's his name? Theodorou.
No, it wasn't
Theodorou. Theodorou played against Levon.
Yeah, he beat Levon. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, I won the game. I had some, like, idea in mind for that game, some prep. It was a bit of a messy game. But this particular line that Wesley played, it's a huge line. It was popular 20 years ago at the highest level, games of Gary.
I was analyzing it with Gary.
Gary played it with both colors. Kramnik, he was a Sveshnikov player. Yeah. People don't remember, but he was a Sveshnikov player. Leko was playing with the white pieces. Probably like Shirov, Swedler, all these
Swedler, great players. Well, actually, he did mention this story about him meeting Swedler on, like, the first ICC platforms, the first iterations of the ICC platform, and they had no idea they're playing against each other because they were both playing on, like, fake accounts, guest accounts, I would assume. And Swedler played something that Kramnik prepared him for. Or, no, that was Anand. That was Anand, 2004. He played against Anand with the white pieces, Gary with black. So it's been going on for a very long time.
Yeah, if you look in the database, you'll see dozens of games at the top level going back early 2000s. And basically, I didn't remember much, but I did remember that after... after I play f5, that back in the day they would castle short, where black has a lot of solutions. And it's also not super critical because black nothing's being attacked, right? So black can play many moves. Like, I think they used to play rook a7 a lot. You can play e4. You can play king h8. Like, you can do a million things. And then I remember there's also a funny draw that people used to go for that starts with bishop c2 and then f4, queen h5. And white takes the pawn h7, but black is winning a piece, and then it's some repetition. And so I had a very vague recollection of this. And then Wesley plays queen h5, which I have no memory of.
Mm-hmm.
Like zero, like absolutely nothing. So I'm on my own. Okay, e4. It's not forced to play e4, but anyway, it's probably the most natural, probably the best move. Bishop c2. And here I start thinking for a long time because I actually just don't know the position.
Yep.
Which sounds maybe a bit embarrassing for a Sveshnikov player, but I just don't know the position. I mean, there are, of course, many games, but it's kind of a forgotten direction. I play knight e5, not a bad move at all. He plays rook d1, good move. He's probably on his own as well, playing rook d1. And I think he had correctly identified probably the best move for black is knight c4, among other good moves, but knight c4 is a good one. And I come up with knight g6. Of course, I see g4, but I'm thinking g4, knight h4 looks good for black. which is far from the case. Knight g6, g4, it's just like, I started to realize that knight h4 is horribly dangerous. Maybe it was the best move, but it's horribly dangerous. A lot of moves just look losing.
Mm.
I'm like, I think for 40 minutes, I'm just in like desperate, complete desperation, because I have such a wide choice of possible moves. And all of them are like on the borderline of maybe okay or maybe losing. It's like, it's a very fine line. They're okay purely by tactics, or they're losing purely by tactics. And in none of them is it double-edged, so it's not like white ever risks. So there's no upside anywhere. So I went for f4, queen h4, first of all because it was direct, because I thought his knight e7 move was okay. It looked okay. Like, I was at least happy with that direction. And I thought the endgame looked possibly tenable. Like, I was very worried about it. Take on h4, and he has a few different directions. I was worried about knight c7. But I think I calculated kind of okay-ish, like to the point that maybe I figured things out. I was very happy he went for 97. So, and then I thought I'm okay, but I misplayed it at some point, like a bit. Like, it was always a bit better for him, and I misplayed it. And then I suddenly got to a bad endgame again, and then it was maybe just losing. But it was, again, very borderline, and he didn't approach it super well in the endgame. I did defend it well.
I think so, yeah. I was just about to say that.
He didn't convert it super well, so he allowed bishop g5. This was a very important moment. And then I'm probably home free, more or less. Like, still dangerous, but but should be... At that point, I was like, probably 60% I draw the game. Before that, I was like, maybe not quite 50% that I'm surviving.
Yeah, just to have the patience to defend those type of endgames is something that most of the top players have. A lot of the... not top players don't have, because it's such a depressing position. It's like you're a pawn down, you have some weaknesses, he's going to be able, you know he's going to be able to like try for the next 50, 60 moves. And you have to be pretty much 100% precise not to make an easy mistake that lose the game on spot. So yeah, those type of situations, I am like very depressing, I'm trying to avoid them. And then in trying to avoid them, these type of end games, I usually lose much, much faster. That's a big problem. But yeah, that was a good escape. Tomorrow you're playing Dak, local favorite. He's been having good tournament so far. Sure, he could have lost against Gukesh, and that would have changed the whole
thing.
He could have also won against Gukesh.
Could have. He was more or less one move from being very close to winning.
Yeah.
Objectively winning, but...
He beat Levon with white piece. Actually,
he beat Levon.
Nice game, I guess. You could blame Levon. He didn't play a very good game, but he did his job.
I would not call it a nice game, honestly. I mean, the first, like, 45 moves were great.
Sure, yeah.
First 45 okay. moves.
I forgot about the
amazing
game.
Yes, I mean, great game. I was like, wow, this guy's playing a great game. Then he, like, I mean, a lot of trivial mistakes.
Yeah.
I mean, King E4.
Time trouble.
No, but King E4 is I cannot explain King E4.
I think it was just a blind spot.
No, sure, this can happen always. You can always explain that. But it's like King E4, okay, you either win the E5 pawn or he gives one check, which forces your king back.
Yeah.
So obviously you should not play King E4. Now, okay, Rook A6, E4, it's maybe some calculation still to do. You know, it's never easy to win.
Yeah.
But King E4 is just a pretty senseless move. And Levon's not playing King F6 really shocked me. I mean, I think Levon was probably thinking, I need to like find something extraordinary to save this game. So he goes for this whole like, okay, rook b3 and e4 and trying to hold by a tempo, which doesn't work out. But it was actually just a fortress. He just plays king f6.
Yeah.
And then after like rook a7, king g6, rook e7.
Yes.
Yeah, you attack the h6 pawn. White attacks the e5 pawn, then you defend the e5 pawn. White has to defend the h6 pawn. Then the rook goes away from e6 to back to a6. Then we play rook b2, we cut the king off again. The king is just trapped on g3. And it's enormously trivial. So I don't really understand the final moments. I mean, yeah, it's strange things happen in chess. It's a difficult game. I mean, it's always easy to critique from the side. But I did feel like it wasn't a difficult endgame at that point. Like, it wasn't difficult to avoid King E4. It wasn't difficult to find King F6.
Yeah.
But okay, it happens.
Yeah, yeah. I mean... there's a lot of explanations for that, but who knows what went on.
Also, I think Norderbeck should have won yesterday against Dayak.
should have?
I mean, really? He had...
I didn't think he was much better. He was better.
Probably objectively, like, winning.
Really?
If he had played queen d3.
Maybe I didn't analyze it properly. Did you analyze it with, like, a strong engine?
I mean, I didn't analyze it. I just saw the evaluation was, like, 1 point...
So it was a lot, yeah?
1 point something. I mean, if considering the position and the time advantage, I think, from a practical point of view, it's very high chances to win. You know, whatever those chances are, are debatable, but very high chances to win.
What's the plan for Dak?
We'll see.
Without going into details, do you have anything like special prepared for the young local hero?
I always have something special prepared for everyone.
Sounds very scary.
Sometimes
let's see what's
sometimes it even surprises me what I come up with in the opening. Like yesterday, I was also surprised.
Yeah,
I didn't even like. Wesley played e4, and then I started having these thoughts, like, Wesley doesn't play e4 against me. He hasn't played e4 against me in years, like 3 years.
Yeah,
in classical. So this first move was already a shock. I was like, wow, Wesley wants to play e4. And then I play e6, so I'm thinking maybe he'll play some g3 stuff, c3 stuff, whatever. He plays d4, another shock. So then I play the four knights. He plays knight db5. I don't think Wesley has really done this too much. Okay, bit of a surprise. Then I'm debating. Bishop b4 is like trying to beg for a draw. I play this against Jan. Okay, I play d6, Sweshnikov. So it's more of a fighting choice. I'm 100% sure that he's going to play knight d5, but then he's starting to pause after b5. So white has two moves. Well, I guess white has more than two moves. There's also knight b1. But white has mainly knight d5 or bishop f6.
Yeah.
But he's starting to pause. And all I'm thinking is, when was the last time I've actually repeated any files after bishop f6? Has it been over 2 years?
Has it?
I don't know. It's been a long time. I don't remember. Knight d5.
Dangerous.
Wesley's only played knight d5, I think. He's never taken f6. Like, what's going on?
Yeah, yeah. Everybody seems to be coming up with new stuff nowadays. Might be just because of the engines. Much easier
very,
to
very
analyze.
Old stuff.
But that's the thing, right? Most people just are going through the old lines that were sort of settled, and everybody thought that this is a draw. This is better for white. This is better for black, whatever. And now they're finding that the assessment is completely different. It's interesting. It's an interesting moment. And I think Gary, again, I've had like 2 30-minute interviews with Gary, so we chatted about this a lot. And he sort of was making the claim that the engines actually made chess much more rich. Like a lot of people were expecting chess to die just because of the engines and most variations to just die, which is the case with some variations, but it also made it more rich.
I mean, from the point of view of what is possible to get away with in chess, now we understand that you can get away with basically anything.
Yeah.
So yeah, in that sense, it's very rich because
you can play anything.
You can play anything, and it more or less works out if you know it and you analyze it well. Engines do make everything pretty playable. On the other hand, Gary doesn't actually have to prepare, so it's easy to say this. If you have to prepare against a guy like Noderbeck or Pragnanta, and they play absolutely everything, and you know that they are going to come up with something which is new, is rare, is very forcing, and usually only provides you like a very narrow window where you have to know a lot and you get a very, very tiny something in return.
You're complaining about them, but you're doing exactly the same.
I mean, everyone does. I'm not complaining. It's just that it's easy to say like, oh, this is very rich, but it's also pretty annoying to prepare for it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I mean, I played against Prague. So I play c4, e5, knight c3, he plays bishop b4, knight d5, he plays a rare move, bishop c5, which of course I have seen before, played against Vichy, played it, I faced against Magnus in Rapid, I faced against Artemiev in Rapid, and I remember basically that white should play like e3, and then knight f6, and b4, and I like have a vague memory that it's supposed to be slightly better, but it's kind of you can analyze it. At some point, it does become forcing. Engines make it playable. And I'll have to remember a lot of stuff, and he'll just blitz out his moves. So instead, I go for something where I'm just freestyling. Like, if I had actually gone for the critical line, which I knew was critical, would I have any chance of outplaying a computer? Of course not.
Right? Probably not.
So I have to kind of play a move. I mean, I don't have to, but I have to, in some sense, to avoid his preparation, play a move which I know is a bit inferior to the best move.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just because I don't want to be playing against someone's preparation.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So against Noderbeck.
And then you hope that that's not in their files.
Well, I mean, I probably know that he's not going to analyze knight e2 because the engine...
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of understand how people prepare because I do the same thing. And if you see that a move allows you like a lot of freedom and an easy position, yeah, you probably have bigger issues to worry about than analyze. Noderbeck plays like completely new line against the Catalan. I mean, I've checked like almost every legal move in these positions.
And but you got a better position, I would say. No.
When?
In
when?
The endgame? The endgame was not better. Mm-hmm. Weak engine was saying that. It was plus 0.5.
Okay, yeah.
Like
no, it's not. It was.
It's not, yeah.
It was at its peak 0.1.
0.1, huh? Yeah.
Which is zeros.
Zeros, yeah.
It's equal.
Yeah, he was a bit concerned. Like, he came to analyze.
No, but he,
me,
was,
and he was.
I
like,
mean,
oh.
We spoke after the game. He was concerned about a position where I take on b4, play knight c5, take with the pawn, put a knight on d4.
Yeah. Yep.
He puts his bishop back on d7,
mm-hmm.
puts his rooks on the e-file, his knight's on f6, I play g4, h4, he plays g6, king, g7, and first of all, I have experience in these positions. Like, I played a game against Jeffrey once, where even the queenside wasn't completely locked up. There are no ideas for white.
It's a fortress.
There are absolutely zero ideas. You cannot break anything, you can't attack b7 in any meaningful way, you have some dark squares, they're completely meaningless. So I knew that it's just an equal position, and it is. Like, a weak engine might show 0.4, whatever. Any reasonable engine will show zeros because it is zeros. It's an equal position.
Yeah.
So there was, like, a kind of intriguing possibility that I could have gone for at the end, which I noticed, but I didn't really believe in. It was like I allow him to take the rook on a1, I play c6. So the exact line was knight c5 instead of, let me try to remember. So knight's on b4, so knight c5, bishop c5, dc5, knight c2, c6. And long line, which, it's actually kind of interesting. It does test him a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still equal in the end. It is zeros. But... if you're, like, absolutely confident that you can go for this and you have more time than your opponent, it's probably a good practical chance, I mean. But I was also less time, and you do have to calculate a lot to go for this because you are sacking a rook, at least temporarily. And, you know, you have to make sure that it doesn't lose, so you have to burn a bit more time. I don't consider it, like, a real chance. Even though I did spot it, it would take me, like, another 10 minutes to get...
It's not practical.
Yeah, to get the confidence to play it. So... I don't feel like I had real chances in those games. I mean, against Prague a bit, but...
No, I would say you maximized whatever you had, your chances.
And yeah, in the sense that I could have lost against Wesley.
You also defended against Wesley.
Could have lost against Wesley. That was
quite key.
So it's not bad so far. Against Duda was not an exciting game.
No.
I was pressing.
You equalized out of the opening, even better.
It's a known trick, knight d4, d5.
Yeah. It did feel like you were creating chances.
I felt that, but he was always ahead on the clock, and, you know, it looked pleasant with the two rooks. Then I allowed c5. I really regretted that, and then there was no more chances after that, unfortunately. But I don't think it was ever really dangerous for him. It could potentially go wrong. There was some potential there. I mean, I do wish I had pressed it at least a bit better, but what to do?
Yeah, tournament going well. Outside of that, Chess World has been rocked somewhat by another scandal, I would say. Not really, I don't know. Occurrence, pretty bad occurrence. Christopher Yu, obviously everybody knows what happened in St. Louis. We covered that in the previous episode. And most people were a bit surprised by the fact that he was still able to play. Not in the US, because he's banned by US Chess for 1 year, but by FIDE. And there's obviously been a problem between US Chess and FIDE. they did not manage to coordinate, because from my understanding, and I think Chris Bird was here, the main arbiter, was mentioning that he has appealed to USGS to make this ban pretty much international, not have it only in the US. Obviously, if you haven't been living under a rock, you know what happened in Sardinia. It seems to have been another case of Christopher alleged harassment of a lady, which has been reported on, and there's been, a few concerning reports, let's just say, and FIDE has suspended Christopher for the next at least 90 days until they come up with more or less exactly what happened and what to do in the future, moving forward. Sad situation. He's only 18. Obviously, doing this type of things is not okay, and we should have, our chess community should gather around and have a safe space for women. This type of thing should not be allowed, and somewhat punished as well. So if he did that, obviously, I think it demands somewhat of a ban. What do you think? What's your take on it? And you don't have to really get into it, because obviously you're focused on your tournament.
No, I don't want to get into too much.
I don't think you should worry too much about drama.
I think that basically it's just, if there's a ban by a local federation, it makes perfect sense for the International Federation, FIDE, to look into it and decide if it merits. I mean, but because, of course, local federations, in a variety of cases, they could be right. Maybe in some cases they could be wrong, right?
That was a huge failure.
No, obviously, in this particular case, the U.S. Federation was correct to ban. But in general, FIDE should look into it and then decide if it... But it should be a cooperation, yeah?
And that makes a lot of sense. It should run smoothly. Like, the cooperation should be smoothly. USGS tells you... I don't know exactly where, you know, that lack of communication happened, whether it didn't come from USGS or, you know, FIDE didn't move fast enough, but they should have been. Look, the guy,
I think
is
they just didn't think about
somebody.
It. I think they just didn't think about it.
Yeah.
It was like kind of, he got banned for what he did in St. Louis.
Yes.
And then FIDE probably just didn't really think about it beyond that. But of course, they should have, and the U.S., again, I don't really know exactly what happened, so I won't comment too much on it, but it would probably, they should send a report to FIDE and recommend, or, you know, because it is kind of a loophole if you do something that merits a ban, and then you can just play internationally.
It's a huge loophole.
That's just a loophole, because then if you have the money to travel, then it's not really a punishment anymore, right?
Zero
so,
punishment.
Like, the reason I say that FIDE shouldn't just blindly follow the same thing is because, of course, there could be cases where a federation unjustly bans someone.
Yeah.
Like maybe, in some countries, people have been banned for let's say, political disputes,
sure.
Like not playing with players of
sure.
a certain country,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
These kinds of things.
Yeah.
So, and it's not always a clear-cut thing. But I think at this point, the ethics committee is kind of just deciding on the case, and they'll probably make the right decision. That's my take on it.
It's a couple of tournaments too late, but that's the way it is. We'll be watching and seeing what's happening. Now, lastly, because I think it's getting pretty late in here and we should be getting some rest, we've had some discussions about certain situations, hypothetical situations of man against animals, and I think we should be continuing on that tangent. We left it at man versus gorilla. What was
a hundred men
versus
people.
One gorilla. We decided that gorilla probably would be overpowered. What was our latest discussion? Was it me versus 50 geese?
Well, I think that you don't stand a chance against even like 10 geese. I think it's absolutely hopeless.
I said I would take 50 geese,
I think,
somewhat easily, but
10 is an absolutely hopeless situation. They're birds. They fly.
They have no damage. So this is
they
my point.
They do.
Geese have no damage. They have a beak. They can, you know, just puncture like, you with it, but
look
not
at the
really.
Ceiling. Imagine that the ceiling above you is filled with geese, because yes. 50 would fill the entire ceiling. Imagine they're raining down on you.
Grab one by the neck.
There's 50
snap
of them.
It. Grab another one. Snap the other
Also,
one.
They're flying at you.
There's no damage. Like, what are they going to do? Fly into me?
Like, this is like the men versus gorilla debate. I mean, you can damage something that's bigger than you. Geese do have... They do have something hard.
How many pounds is a geese?
Is a goose?
Goose.
I don't know.
5 pounds.
Mm,
10?
Mm, not 5.
Not more than 10, right?
Maybe 10. I mean, birds
10
are...
10 is a big goose. 10 is a big goose.
Okay, yeah. It can be... Which goose are we kind of talking about? That's the question. A Canada goose... 3.2 to 6.5
kilos.
Okay, give
me a small goose. Give me an average goose.
It seems like they're not going below 3 kilos.
That's like 8 pounds, yeah? Something like that.
They're not I mean, they're small, obviously. They're birds. The birds are light. But anyway, they're flying down on you. They have a beak.
I don't believe in geese too much. So if you say 50, that's the... 20, absolutely no chance.
I don't think you have any chance against
20. 20, no chance. No, no, no. Geese have absolutely no chance, 20. I would, like, smash them.
You don't, like, again, it's this numbers thing. You don't understand how much you're overwhelmed. They're just, again, we assume some, because geese won't actually coordinate an attack against a human.
A much more interesting discussion I think we had last night. This one is debatable. Let's say you agree. We agree to disagree. The other one was man versus ostrich and 3 cats. So,
well, you have the cats.
I have the cats.
Yeah.
Me with 3 house cats by my side against an ostrich.
Yeah, I'm proud of this one. This was a great fight suggestion.
You're proud of this one.
Cuz I think against an ostrich you're in serious trouble.
Well, we started with an ostrich, and I do agree that it's probably going to be bad.
Ostrich is scary.
They have a lot of weapons,
They run pretty fast.
Their claws are pretty sharp. Yeah, no.
And they're big. They're like 7 feet tall, I think.
I would not feel very comfortable.
Not sure actually how tall they are. I might be making that up.
Did we find out whether the rumor that the ostrich hides his head in the sand is
Oh,
is
okay.
Correct?
They are actually, they're actually 7 to 9 feet in height.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Okay. Zero chance.
Yeah. Maybe if you cut the legs off an ostrich, then you would be doing good.
To be honest, no. Even with the 3 house cats.
Well, the thing is, 3 cats, I mean, if they're coordinated cats, cats are extremely fast. They have claws.
Cats are strong. Yeah.
And they're like natural bird predator. They'll see the ostrich as...
no way they see the ostrich as prey. Zero chance.
It's a big bird, but still...
It's a dinosaur.
But
the ostrich is basically a dinosaur.
Yeah, but the cats, dinosaur. I mean, obviously the cats are... I mean, the thing is, like, three tigers will take down a giraffe.
Yes, obviously.
Well, not obviously. A giraffe's
enormous. It has no damage.
What do you mean it has no damage? It has, like, really powerful kicks.
How did you know that? Wait, I'm not convinced about
giraffes
that.
Are huge, and they're so strong.
Obviously, they're huge.
They're also really strong.
Okay.
But okay, it's just
I don't
cats,
have data on that.
Cats do coordinate very well, and they'll eventually, like, take... They'll wear the giraffe down. It takes a long time, I think.
You mean tigers, not the cats?
Well, I mean,
tigers for giraffe.
I mean, not house.
Oh, okay. The felines.
Yeah.
Okay, felines. Okay, cats. Big
they
cats.
They are cats.
Big cats. Yeah.
So, 3 house cats. I mean, they'll definitely do some. They'll stress the bird out.
That they would. Yes.
Yeah.
Do they hide their heads in the sand? Because if they do that, then I got it. I mean, it's easy.
No, again, we assume that the ostrich is out for the kill.
Let's see. Do ostrich hide their heads in the sand?
3 cats is a really powerful weapon.
You think so?
Yeah.
Hmm. But this is house cats. These are not stray cats. They've never been in a fight before. They
again,
just
we assume
act
that
on instinct.
The animals know that they have to fight.
It's instinct.
It's like the geese...
Like, by the way, ostriches do not stick their heads in the sand.
Yeah, that sounds like a myth.
I guess.
No, but the ostrich is fighting you. You're going to have to...
Yeah.
So basically, you send the cats forward.
Okay.
And then what you're going to need to do is you're going to need to mount the ostrich.
I need to get behind the head, yes.
You need to mount it, which is probably very difficult.
It's not easy.
So the cats are a distraction.
How do you mount an ostrich?
It's like
you a horse. You don't have a saddle.
It's like a horse.
Yeah, but you don't have a saddle.
You just jump one leg over.
Yeah, I don't know. It's tough. It's tough. I think the ostrich is tough.
But I don't. I think with the cats, you have a reasonable chance. I mean, it's.
It could be that the cats would take down the ostrich by themselves.
Okay, in that case, you're good.
And I don't actually have to do anything. I just have to give.
The thing is, if you like get blow. If you get around the neck,
yeah,
with the cats, I think the ostrich is going down.
Do they tire out easily?
Every animal gets tired.
Do ostrich tire out easily? What? Let's see. I don't think they do.
Okay,
and the ostrich runs 30 miles per hour and has the endurance to keep it for hours on end.
Yeah, but that's endurance running. Like, you can take a marathon runner...
30 miles an hour.
Okay.
That's a lot.
Okay, they're fast.
They're fast.
But you could take a marathon runner. That doesn't mean that he's going to be good at fighting house cats. These are different skill sets.
I don't feel comfortable against the ostrich.
But you have the cat. Okay. I mean, it's your fight.
What do you mean it's my fight? It's a hypothetical fight. And I'm just like...
For now.
The design person for the moment.
For now.
Yes. Yes. How about... We also came up with another one. You, let's say, or me, or whatever, against, what did we say, 20 flamingos?
20 flamingos, yeah. But I think we decided that flamingos are really not a dangerous bird. They weigh about 5 pounds.
They're very skinny. Very, very skinny.
And I also don't... I've seen an entire flock. They call it a flock, right? Of flamingos.
Sure, yeah.
At an amusement park. Extremely non-threatening.
Mm.
Now, if they're really devoted to the fight, maybe, I don't know, but...
They have no instinct. They have no predatory instinct.
No, that's true.
Probably.
No, I mean, the ostrich is an interesting one because that's an extremely aggressive bird.
Ostrich will destroy you, to be honest. The more I think about it...
But the cat, I mean, the cats are...
The cats is a good weapon to have, but I don't believe too much.
I think 3 cats is also a reasonable amount because if you have, like, 5 cats... I think they'll take down the ostrich on their own.
Depending on how much damage the cats have. Because, look, they're pretty small. These are house cats. They're not
but they have claws.
They do have claws.
Like, you've been scratched by a cat.
Yeah, but the ostrich, I mean, you can imagine the skin of the ostrich is extremely probably tough.
Why do you assume that?
That's my guess. It's a guess. I don't know. I haven't.
These are like tiny daggers. I mean... No, but cats have really sharp claws.
That's true. That is true.
I mean,
I've been scratched by cats.
I've been scratched sometimes kind of deep by my cat, and they can go deep.
Mm.
You know, it's not going to kill you, but and the thing is, they also have incredibly fast reflexes.
That's true.
So maybe they can avoid kicks. Because if they get kicked, I think it's over for the cats.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
I think one kick will do it for... It's absolutely game over for any cat who gets kicked by an ostrich.
Well, I guess let us know in the comments what you think about this whole discussion and whether you have any interesting ideas for analysis for future episodes. That's all we can say for the moment. Don't forget, like, subscribe, watch the Grand Chess Tour. It's going to happen on St. Louis Chess Club and the Grand Chess Tour YouTube channels. And... I will be doing commentary. Fabi's going to play. And he's going to be trying to take the victory in the next 4 rounds. So go show your support and subscribe to show your support for the channel. Cheers, guys.